this week's program, we ask, what next for the Philadelphia Orchestra? As Chapter 11 hearings proceed, we speak with the orchestra's board chair, Richard Worley, and John Cohen, the orchestra cellist who heads the Musicians Committee. Susan Lewis considers a new exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia that looks back at Andy Warhol's first solo museum show at the ICA in 1965. And we speak with Thomas Meaney of the Flute Society of Greater Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Following last weekend's Philadelphia Orchestra Board decision to file for Chapter 11 protection under the bankruptcy laws, hearings in federal court began on Wednesday. The orchestra projects a multi-million dollar gap between income and expenses in the current financial year. Chapter 11 provides a process for reorganization which will allow the orchestra to continue to function and perform concerts while receiving a measure of protection from its creditors. And in the cause of full disclosure, we should say that WRTI is one of those creditors. The filing comes in the wake of stalled labour contract talks between management and musicians, whose current agreement expires in September. Orchestra musicians strongly protested against the moves towards bankruptcy, and musicians on the board were the only ones to vote against the decision to file. They claim that their earlier offer of reductions in salary and benefits, if taken up by management, would have made bankruptcy protection unnecessary. The board maintains that the long-term health of the organisation will improve only with radical changes to its contractual commitments to the Kimmel Centre and to Peter Nero and the Philly Pops, but most importantly to its pension obligations. The orchestra seeks to withdraw from a current defined benefit plan administered by the Musicians' Union and move to a defined contribution plan that would lock in the orchestra's commitments but make benefits to the musicians variable. In a few minutes we'll hear from Musicians Committee Chairman John Cohen, but first Orchestra Board Chair Richard Worley, who was keen to downplay the apparent conflict over the pension plan and optimistic that a new strategic plan unveiled this week could bring long-term stability to the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This isn't a matter between our musicians and ourselves. It is primarily a matter between both of us and the plan. We wish to withdraw from the plan. That's something we would have to negotiate with our musicians in the collective bargaining process in which we are engaged.
You get out of this plan by paying off this 20-something million dollars.
There's a withdrawal. Right, there's a withdrawal liability. It's sort of a get-out-of-jail.
Right. Well, not free.
It's a get-out-of-jail pass.
So by withdrawing from this, you wouldn't be leaving the current retirees or even the current members of the orchestra without a retirement fund.
That's correct.
You would then go to a new plan.
Well, we would need to negotiate a new plan with our musicians.
You've been in court for the last 3 days now. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been the reaction to an organization with $140 million in endowment coming in and saying we're broke?
Well, there's a lot of confusion about our endowment. A number of years ago, we had a total endowment of close to $200 million. That was an endowment for the Academy of Music and for the Philadelphia Orchestra. The orchestra's component of that endowment was about $175 million, 30 of which was unrestricted. In struggling to pay expenses that are greater than revenues, we have exhausted the unrestricted component of our endowment. It's down to a couple of million and represents our last remaining cash reserve. The remainder, which for the orchestra is about $120 million today, $20 million for the Academy of Music in addition to get to the current $140 million balance that has been quoted, is all in the form of restricted gifts.
Restricted to what?
Well, they are restricted either by their form. Some are in trust, where the orchestra really does not own the asset. It merely has the use of the interest and return on the asset. It's sort of like a trust fund, I guess. Others are not in trust but are restricted by donor intent, meaning instructions to us on how to use the assets over time. But the main point is that these are not assets that either by law or donor restriction we can dip into the principal of. We really are in some ways custodians of the assets, and the use of the proceeds of the return proceeds on those assets is for the perpetual benefit of the orchestra.
We've gotten to this situation through a variety of factors, an aging audience, the economy tanking. That said, is there anything for which the Philadelphia Orchestra Association is responsible? Can we look at anything that's happened over the last 5 or 6 years and say we would do it differently if we were starting out again?
There are probably a lot of things that we would do differently. It would go back longer than 5 years. 20 years ago, the Philadelphia Orchestra drew the second largest audience of any orchestra in America, about 250,000 per year to our regular subscription season concerts. That has declined to 150,000. It's been a long declining trend. The trend accelerated in the recession, but it is something that we have to fix and turn around if we are to maintain a great orchestra in this city.
What would you have done differently?
Well, I, and for many of the decisions, I wasn't there, and
so then you can speak without incriminating yourself.
Well, but I don't. We know of decisions that have turned out badly, but in the face of uncertainty, decisions always have the possibility of turning out badly or well. And knowing the facts at the time that were known by my predecessors, I'm not sure what I would have done differently at the time.
There's now the seeds of a strategic plan, central to which is clearing the decks of these toxic liabilities.
Well, the strategic plan is really a plan to revitalize the orchestra and address the fundamental issues that have led to the decline in attendance and the relatively low contribution level of this orchestra. Not only is our attendance down, but compared with other major orchestras with whom we compete for the greatest musicians in America, the level of private support for our orchestra is roughly half that of other major cities.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. We're going to try to change it. I don't think it's because Philadelphians are ungenerous.
Or poor.
Or poor. I think it is because we haven't done a good enough job of raising the orchestra to a level of philanthropic priority to which it must rise.
You've had conversations with potential donors. What have they told you personally?
Well, I've had a lot of conversations, and they have all been different. There are some common elements. Our budget deficit is roughly one-third of our expense budget. We have $45 or $46 million of expenses and about $31 million of revenues. That is just an enormous gap. It's a gap that is simply too big to be sustained by the donations of a few. And so when we have talked with donors, they've said it's too big to continue and we must create a plan to reduce and then eliminate the deficit. They, I believe, view the possibility of helping us as a very substantial investment on their part. And like any investor, they are looking for, well, a return on the investment, not to themselves, but to the city. They need to think it's a sound investment in order to contribute millions of dollars to us.
Final question. Well, what effect do you feel these bankruptcy hearings or the mere filing of Chapter 11 status will have on the reputation of the orchestra?
Well, I've thought about that a lot, and when the emperor has no clothes, I'm not sure that acknowledging it causes reputational harm. I think the situation causes whatever reputational harm there is. I believe that by acknowledging it and acting decisively with a plan and a determined effort to raise the money from the community, and we will need the help of the community, to turn around this orchestra, implement our recovery plan, and rebuild a solid future for it, that in 5 years our reputation will be very different than it is today. We can't do anything about what our reputation is today. I think we can have a major influence in building a terrific reputation for our orchestra going forward by virtue of what we do over these next 5 years.
Philadelphia Orchestra Board Chairman Richard Worley. Cellist John Cohen is head of the Musicians Committee and one of four musicians on the orchestra board. He says the musicians were opposed to the Chapter 11 filing and would rather see no changes in their pension arrangements right now, but that he and his colleagues are open to change to safeguard the future of the orchestra.
The musicians have proposed that we stay in the AFM plan for now, not seek for any higher return on investment to allow a time for the plan to recover more this would have two effects. Either the board of the plan would agree to implement an increased benefit at some future date, or if the plan is somewhat better funded, the withdrawal liability will be reduced. So it would cost less than that in the future based on market performance.
You've put these ideas to the board. What was the response?
I would say they listened politely and made no further response. We've, of course, negotiated about the matters, and they've written down our ideas and also made no real response.
This problem didn't show up on Saturday. How did we get here?
Well, I think there has been a problem of, I've been in the orchestra 21 years, and I would say for at least 18 of those years, and most likely more than that, the problems must have started before I was really aware of it. The management and the board has not really authorized enough money to be spent on marketing and development. The Philadelphia Orchestra Association spends about half of what its peers and even not peer orchestras spends on marketing, if you take it as a percentage of budget. And this has been a problem for almost the entire time I've been here.
But some would argue that 18 years ago they didn't need to.
18 years ago, there was beginning to be some softness in ticket sales, and the board, I think, did not react quickly to any problems.
Let's go back then just 6 years. Six years ago, you had an endowment, you had a balanced budget, you had a record deal, you had a music director in place, and you had approximately going on for 90% attendance. That degraded fairly quickly. What were the factors involved in that, to your mind?
Right around that time, 2005, 2006, there were problems in leadership. We had a music director transition that was unfortunately more messy than would be hoped. Following on that, we had transitions in board chairmanship and several transitions in the top management position. So all of those factors, I think, led to some instability, but particularly the artistic factor of uncertainty about music directorship, which persisted for a number of years, had to be one of the causes for audience decline.
And how much, say, do the musicians as a group have today? You say the board listened politely. Have they always only listened politely?
No. For instance, in the music director search, which resulted in hiring Yannick as our next music director, the board retained the final authority on making the decision, but the board did adopt the unanimous recommendation of the musicians' committee.
And were red flags raised by the musicians in terms of the other issues you refer to, the marketing and the development? Were you guys aware of that? Because this is a group of 100 and something, very innovative, very creative, very driven people.
Sure. Those points about marketing development in particular have been raised repeatedly over, I would say, really the entire time I've been a member of the orchestra. There have been some disagreements as to specifics of marketing campaigns, but in general, the real reason is that not enough money was spent. And I am also aware that there have been budgets prepared by management repeatedly over the years, which, after the board approved the budgets, those amounts for marketing and development had been reduced.
There is a systemic problem here, aging audience, the concert experience being really not what the kids want. It's not interactive. You're in a dark room where you're not allowed to speak. You're not allowed to react to what you're seeing. There's a certain amount of ceremony that you have to learn before you can even darken that darkened room. How much do you feel that contributes to the non-replacement of the aging audience?
I think things maybe go in cycles, and I haven't, you know, I'm not familiar enough with the data to give you a definitive answer, but we have a program sponsored by the Neubauer Family Foundation that provides tickets for college students if they register and pay a small fee.
And is it working? Is it putting college students in seats?
It's filling lots of seats on nights where the attendance is sparser than we would like. And yes, there's a lot of college students that we see coming in to concerts. And some audience members really enjoy sitting next to young people, and some of them are actually quite knowledgeable about music. I've spoken to some of them in the lobby after concerts occasionally. And other patrons are not so happy with someone spending less than they are for the ticket.
That said, that doesn't get you past the idea that if, A, somebody doesn't have any prior knowledge of what it is they're going to hear, if they don't understand the ritual that is going to a classical music concert, the impediments are still there. Besides, we've gotten rid of the price problem. The other impediments still exist. How can you deal with those?
I would say the musicians of the orchestra are not wedded to the traditional concert experience. However, if there is a segment of our patrons who is most comfortable that way, then they should be provided for, as we are providing new opportunities for enhancing or changing the concert experience for newer listeners.
So you'd have two different, totally different, radically different types of concerts.
At least. I think you'd have to, you know, when they talk about experimenting with smartphone apps and so forth, as a dedicated smartphone user myself, I think that could be interesting. And for people who may be less knowledgeable, if it's providing more knowledge about what they're listening to, particularly if it's in real time, that could really be a super enhancement to the concert. But at the same time, if you're somebody who is already familiar or who prefers to experience music in a more oral, you know, listening way, then those sort of things happening next to you could be very distracting. So I think we have to be very careful how we mix these new ideas. I've been on stage when people have used like pen lights or something to read the music, and sometimes I can see it like a semaphore from the distance.
That said, if you're going to go into this brave new world of interactivity and the concert experience being more like, say, I don't know, a gig, how open to the idea do you think the musicians would be to, I don't know, people talking in the audience, people reacting in places where they're not supposed to react, applauding a cadenza, clapping in between movements?
You know, the orchestras will adapt. Some artists react better than others to applause interruptions. And I think these are just sort of societal, you know, and small, in a way, cultural changes that, you know, evolve as, because art needs to be alive. It needs to change.
Philadelphia Orchestra cellist John Cohen. And we'll continue to update this story here and in WRTI News as it develops.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Many of Andy Warhol's silk screens have become iconic. Images of things as ordinary as Campbell's soup can labels and as glamorous as Marilyn Monroe. But he also created superstar personas, starting with himself. A new exhibition organized jointly by the Institute of Contemporary Art and 12 art history students from the University of Pennsylvania focuses on one night in 1965 when art and celebrity collided. It was the opening of Andy Warhol's first solo museum show at the ICA when an estimated 2,000 people showed up. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers a new exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art. That's How We Escaped, Reflections on Warhol.
It was Friday, October 8th, 1965. The ICA director at the time, Samuel Green, who died this past March, anticipated the opening of Andy Warhol's first solo museum exhibition to be an extraordinary event. Warhol was an art school-trained, successful New York City graphic designer who was trying to forge his way into the fine art world. For the opening, Green had sent out invitations adorned with a Campbell's soup can label, contacted the media, and put his own publicity machine into high gear. Green was, says ICA curatorial fellow Virginia Solomon, a marketing genius.
The way that Sam was able to use Warhol's work, but also sort of like the Warholian notion of working and the Warholian observations about the potential for art to be a popular culture event, there's sort of this perfect storm confluence that happened on this night that was as much, I think, Sam Green's publicity acumen as it was Warhol's artistic acumen.
Adding to the unusual nature of the evening, after a boom mic had fallen through one of the paintings during a crowded preview party the night before, Green decided to take down nearly all of the art to protect it at the opening. Sam Schnittman, one of the 12 University of Pennsylvania student curators of the current exhibition, focused his research on what happened that night at the ICA, then housed in what is now the Fisher Fine Arts Library, when Andy Warhol showed up, entourage in tow, with actress Edie Sedgwick on his arm.
About 2,000, even estimates range as high as 4,000 people show up at this gallery in an extremely small space. Normally, no more than 400 people could fit into it, but nevertheless, they all fit in there. And when they come, they're not there for the art, because there's no art on the wall. You know, there's a picture here or there, but they're there to see Andy and Edie.
Faced with a mob and only a handful of security guards, Warhol and his companions climbed a corner staircase, only to find that the exit at the top had been sealed. Trapped, Warhol and Sedgwick engaged the crowd from the top of the stairs.
And so Edie is dancing, and they were passing cans of Campbell's soup up to him to be signed. And after 4 hours, eventually, several grad students were able to axe their way through the ceiling, and they escaped through the library's rare book stacks over the ceiling and then out to where the police could protect them.
The sensational night, thousands of fans at an art opening without the art, marked a turning point in Warhol's career, says Virginia Solomon.
that Andy and Evie are able to hold their attention to the degree that they are signals this shift wherein the art object stops being the painting and starts actually being Warhol and the people that Warhol is able to make and put in the public eye.
This exhibition is the culmination of student research on that night. The 24 works displayed include sketches by Warhol, a blouse and a lithograph made with repeated images of S&H green stamps, and photographs of the preview party and the opening night. Sam Schnittman says many of those attending were Penn students.
But there's also a lot of the Philadelphia upper class who were there. So it was actually a really interesting sight to see, because you have all these students dancing next to all these upper class women in all these gowns, and these students are wearing jeans. It's a really big mix of people. You know?
Also in the current exhibition is a new work commissioned by the ICA. The staircase that went nowhere on which Warhol spent the evening is recalled by a new sculpture by artist Alex DeCorte. A section of staircase is perched high on a wall.
I was thinking about the space in which he was trapped.
The stairs of the sculpture are overflowing with wildflowers, which DeCorte painted with conditioner, shampoo, and soda.
They're actually fake flowers that smell fragrant, but they're plastic. And I think that sort of feels a lot like Warhol. You know, he was sort of a plastic idea of himself at that point, or the image of celebrity, and there's something kind of interesting about, like, the human bit of him, maybe hiding from, like, this superstardom that is his work.
After the ICA show, Andy Warhol continued to work and nurture his own celebrity, as well as those people he described as superstars. His gathering place in New York was his studio, dubbed The Factory.
The Factory was this crazy amalgam of people, from society kids to drag queens, but people also who came from money. There'd be, you know, like crazy kind of parties where all kinds of stuff would happen. People would do all kinds of drugs. It was this sort of cultural capital, if you will, that is getting produced through this factory.
Warhol made art from images in newspapers and other media. He made portraits of celebrities, from Elizabeth Taylor to Chinese leader Mao Zedong. Other subjects ranged from the ordinary to the horrific, as in his series of images of car crashes and other disasters.
He made in reaction to what he was seeing. So if it was soup that he saw every day, then he made something about soup. Like, I think for him it was really direct. You know, if the headline flooded the newspapers, he just observed it and then was saying that just to recreate it or to make it bigger makes you kind of reconsider it.
He befriended younger artists, including Jean-Michel Basquiat, promoted rock bands like the Velvet Underground, designed album covers for Diana Ross and Aretha Franklin, and brought others into the production of silkscreens, films, and other art. While he was criticized by the art establishment for mixing commerce and art, the way he worked, gathered people, and cultivated his own celebrity provoked new ways of thinking about what art could be, and paved the way for new expressions, like performance and video art, says Virginia Solomon.
The fact that Warhol was taking images from popular culture and using them as the, you know, basis for the paintings that he made was certainly a shift in terms of ideas about, you know, the artist is genius who comes up with always his ideas from, you know, his soul and his artistic connection to some eternal truths about humanity or what have you. And Warhol, by making these screen prints, was breaking away from that to a certain extent because he wasn't coming up with his material. But by highlighting the artist as something, like the artist personality, the artist persona itself as something that was made, he sort of pointed to another truth.
But what was behind the public persona, the trendy pop sensation? By all accounts, Andy Warhol, born Andrew Warhola to working-class immigrants from Pittsburgh, as a child was often homesick, where he collected celebrity photographs and ate a lot of Campbell's soup. The private side of the adult Andy Warhol, who was shot in 1968 and recovered, but who died in 1987 at the age of 58 from complications after gallbladder surgery, remains an enigma.
He has that famous quote that he says, if you want to know about me, just look at the surface of my paintings. I am the surface of my paintings. Everything that you want to know about me is visible there.
It was Andy Warhol who predicted, in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. In Warhol's world, the commonplace and the fantastical, the whimsical and the somber, all become fodder for a society that continues to build an ever faster, ever bigger media machine. Andy Warhol personified the contradictions and possibilities of a celebrity-driven culture. An observer, observed, an artist who becomes the art, and a public sensation who could attract thousands, even after his paintings had been taken off the walls.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. That's How We Escaped, Reflections on Warhol, is at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia through August 7th. The flute is one of the oldest musical instruments, but as orchestras typically have only 2 to 4 flutists, a lot of classically trained players must look for performance opportunities elsewhere, and may even cross over into other musical genres, folk, pop and the like. Less attractive to not only classically trained flutists is jazz. Improvisation is a skill that isn't generally part of classical training. But next weekend, the Flute Society of Greater Philadelphia hopes to help tame the fears of at least some of its members. I spoke with Thomas Meaney, the Society's Vice President. There seems to be a great degree of crossover among players, and there doesn't seem to be the reticence among flute players that you get with other instrumentalists to take on music that isn't of their own background. You get classical musicians playing all kinds of different things. You get folk musicians trying jazz, and there seems to be, is there a great deal of cross-pollination between different genres?
I think for several reasons. First of all, the traditional, what we're taught when we first pick an instrument, or maybe to have it more serious when we enter the college level, the ultimate goal is always to be symphonic, to be in the orchestra. But it's extremely limited. 3 or 4 flutists in an orchestra, if you're lucky. And once they get their jobs, guess what? They stay there. And so what do flutists do? We want to play. Flutists want to perform. So they have to look for other venues, such as flute societies. We have things for our members to play, flute choirs. We have opportunities for them to give an informal recital. We call it the open members recital we do every year at the end of the season. And then, jazz flute, and as you mentioned, folk music.
And you have this cross-pollinization between different genres of flute players.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any snobbery in there? Is there certain things that classical guys won't play?
I don't think it's limited to flute players, but I think in any profession, some people are more uptight, some more and more self-centered. And I think that with any instrument, almost any profession.
How about you?
Oh, no.
Well, let's talk about the event you've got coming up on Saturday with Jamie Baum.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the cross-pollinization between different genres. Most classical pianists, classical violinists, you show them jazz and they run for the hills. Mm-hmm. But this is an artist who does primarily jazz, but seems to be comfortable in all arenas.
She has a strong classical background. And then I think towards her graduate school training, she aspired to more jazz performances and also to composition. She uses a lot of classical motifs and themes in a lot of her music. You bring up some classical musicians hearing jazz and going, oh, no, not for me.
Or just seeing it on the page. Like, here's your section that you can play now, improvise. And they go, what?
Funny you should bring it up. As I said, Jamie is giving a clinic for Flute Society members called A Fear-Free Approach to Improvisation for the Classically Trained Flutist. In other words, flutists who know next to nothing about jazz improvisation. A fear-free approach to that. So, myself, I'm going as well.
Well, do you have fear?
I have a little fear. If I was in a situation that's improvised for a few moments as something else is going on, I think I would be concerned. I think part of our training, if it's not on the page, we kind of rebel or hold back.
Flute Society of Greater Philadelphia Vice President Thomas Meaney. The Society presents A Fear-Free Approach to Improvisation for the Classically Trained Flutist, featuring the renowned jazz flutist Jamie Baum, a week from today at noon at Kaplan Hall at the University of the Arts. Baum will also perform with her septet at the same venue at 2. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.